In this episode, we talk with author Greg McEwen and the way of the essentialist in LDS leadership.
It came as a result of the position of leadership which was imposed upon us by the God of heaven who brought forth a restoration of the gospel of Jesus Christ. And when the declaration was made concerning the only and only true and living church upon the face of the earth, we were immediately put in a position of loneliness, the loneliness of leadership, from which we cannot shrink nor run away, and to which we must face up with boldness and courage and ability.
Welcome back to the Leading LDS Podcast. My name is Kurt Frankum. I am the host of such podcast, and I welcome you back. If you're new to Leading LDS, this is a place where we talk about all things leadership in the context of the LDS Church. I encourage you to go to leadinglds.org. I'm trying to make that transition to leadinglds.org because we are on the cusp of being a nonprofit, and so you can definitely find Leading LDS at leadinglds.org. But I encourage you to go to leadinglds.org and peruse through the articles and episodes that we have there. We've done just about 160 episodes on Leading LDS, so there's a lot to peruse through, and many people go right back to the beginning and listen to every single episode, and trust me, you will not regret it. Also want to give a shout out to the many Patreon supporters who have who've been so kind to respond to my request to give at least a dollar a month. Shout out to my mom. She gives every month. Karen, love you, Mom. Craig Riddle, Corey Hansen, Rob Elkins, Blair Tingey, you are wonderful supporters, and I can't thank you enough for how you're supporting, and we'll give more shout outs to individuals that are on that long list of people helping to support and contribute to Leading LDS so that we can continue doing this and expand and get into greater content that will help you enhance your ability as a leader in the church. Now, sit down, buckle up. This is a fantastic interview. Now, if you're asking me at this point, out of the 160 or so episodes that I've done, this is easily probably in my top five, if not my top three favorite episodes. My guest is Greg McEwen, and he is the author of Essentialism, The Disciplined Pursuit of Less. He is also the co-author to Multipliers, which we've talked a lot about. He co-authored that book with Liz Wiseman, who you should check out the interviews we've done on Leading LDS. Very powerful, knows her stuff, very smart lady. Now, to give you some background on who Greg McEwen is, I'll just read his bio from his website, which is gregmcewen.com. It says, Greg McEwen has dedicated his career to discovering why some people break through to the next level and others don't. The definitive treatment of this issue is addressed in McEwen's latest project, the instant New York Times and Wall Street Journal bestseller, Essentialism, The Disciplined Pursuit of Less. As well as frequently being the number one time management book on Amazon, this book challenges core assumptions about achievement to get to the essence of what really drives success. McEwen is the CEO of This Inc., a company whose mission is to assist people and companies to spend 80% of their time on the vital few rather than the trivial many. Clients include Adobe, Apple, Google, Facebook, Pixar, Salesforce.com, Symantec, Twitter, VMware, and Yahoo. His writing has appeared or been covered by Fast Company, Fortune, HuffPost, Politico, and Inc. magazine. He is among the most popular bloggers for the Harvard Business Review and LinkedIn's influencer group, averaging 1 million views a month. McEwen has been interviewed on numerous television and radio shows, including NPR's All Things Considered and NBC's Press Here, Entrepreneur Magazine, voted his interview at Stanford University the number one must-see video on business, creativity, and success. And I will add to that interview, he's now being interviewed on the Leading LDS Podcast, but he is a bishop in Menlo Park, California, and a fantastic leader. So here is my interview with Greg McEwen, the author of Essentialism, The Disciplined Pursuit of Less. Today, I'm very excited to welcome an author that I've been following his last few books and been following the content he puts online and really has been life-changing and impactful for me. And that person is Greg McEwen. How are you, Greg?
Oh, I'm just doing wonderful. Thanks for having me.
Yeah, for sure. Now, you are in, is it Menlo Park area in California?
That's it.
Now, you don't sound like your accent doesn't sound too Menlo Parkian, yeah, but
I love how that sounded like you said accident, referring to my accent.
No, there's nothing accidental about your accent.
Yeah, I'm from London, England originally, and grew up in Leeds in Yorkshire in the north of England.
Wow, great. And so I know there's a long story behind it, but generally speaking, how did you land all the way over to California from London?
Well, it really started right when I came home from my mission and enrolled in law school. And I just was so hungry to feel the sense of mission and to maintain the sense of mission I'd felt for 2 years. And I just couldn't seem to feel it fully in law. And there's nothing wrong with law, of course, there's lots of important work to be done there, but I just could not sense my unique mission there, but I was still in it. And then I was actually the story that's interesting, I reflected on recently because I was back there, is I went to visit somebody in the church office building. And they said something just curious and in passing. They said, look, if you do decide to stay in America, then you should come and help us with this event. And it wasn't so much what they wanted me to do as that question and the assumption of if you didn't have to do what you're doing, if you could do something different, what would it be? And so I went down the foyer of the church office building and wrote down on a piece of paper, what would you do if you could do anything? And I brainstormed the answers for the next 20 minutes. And when I was finished, what I was struck by was not what was on the list, but what was not on the list. And law school was not on the list. It wasn't the thing. And so what do you do? And really what I think that moment came down to is, are you going to do what is good? Are you going to do what you've said in the past you're going to do, or are you going to do the Lord's will and the Lord's way at the Lord's time? And that's a different challenge. That's a much different criteria for making a decision. And finally, as I was grappling with that, I thought, well, I better call my parents. And so I called the 15-digit number back to England, and my mother answered, fortunately. And she said, I think you better talk to Dad. And so he comes on the phone. What are you going to say?
Right.
After all that time, money, effort, your son's halfway around the world. He's got a harebrained idea to not do what he's been doing. Actually what happened is he listened. It's not entirely like him. And then because all Englishmen quote Shakespeare over tea and crumpets for breakfast in the morning, he pulls out this line from Hamlet. He says, son, you know what we always told you. And he says, to thine own self be true. And I mean, incidentally, he never said that to me in his whole life.
Wow.
But and then he added this, which you'll recognize. He said, do what is right. Let the consequence follow.
Nice.
And so that was it. Never went back to law school.
Wow. And in hindsight, I'm guessing you don't regret that decision.
I've never regretted it in the short, medium, or long, or the long run, not even for a moment. But I don't think we do regret decisions where we just have those moments of clarity of this is the right direction, this is what we're supposed to do, this is where we're supposed to go from here. And of course, it doesn't mean you have all the answers forever going forward. Of course, you don't. In fact, that little story is really sort of the work of life, my view. It's not that we get an answer and then we're done. It's not focus as a noun. It's focus as a verb. It's this continual, perpetual effort to figure out what is the Lord's will for me? What is the timing he has in mind for me? And to seek that so constantly, to admit often that we don't have the answers. I mean, I only half jokingly would share it this way, that there's only two kinds of people in the world. And the first are people who are lost. And the second type of person is someone who knows they are lost.
Yeah.
And it's that second category. If we can get ourselves into that place, when I'm staring at that piece of paper in my hands, I know I'm lost. I don't, what am I to do?
Yeah.
What is the right path? And if we can get ourselves into that mindset, if we can get our heart condition into that place of really humility, broken heart, contrite spirit, that's the idea, isn't it? But if you can get into that place, then you know what to do. In a sense, if you're lost and you know you're lost, you're not lost anymore.
Right.
And that becomes this continual, perpetual journey that I feel like I'm still on. And that's sort of how it all began.
Well, that's great. That's great. Now, I'm curious about your background a little bit. Being LDS in London, did you come from a long history of members in the church, or is there are you a first generation Mormon, second generation? How did that?
On my mother's side, she was a convert at 17, and. So a couple of her friends had just invited her to an activity, and it was just a few weeks after that she joined the church and just transformed her whole life and her sense of who she was, and compared to how she'd understood herself before. So it was a massive transformational experience. And on my father's side, my grandparents, there were two missionaries. Who were exhausted, tired out, and decided to knock on three more doors in London. And they knocked into my grandparents, and that equally transformational, but in a different way. They went on to be the first, to my knowledge, the first non-US temple president and matron in the world, serving in London for several years. Wow. And they've both passed away now, but they're, you know, who they are, what the trade-offs they made, what they represent. I mean, their example just thunders down to me. That's the longer story.
Yeah. So, how would you describe, you know, in your upbringing, obviously being raised in an LDS home, how would you describe the development of your personal testimony?
When I think about Joseph Smith as the master asker, I feel like there was a lot of that in my home. There was not a sense of, for me, there was not a sense of this is how it is. It was you always need to go to God to figure this out. You know, there was a testimony. It was clear. There was no ambiguity around that for me growing up. But it was also as clear as that I had to be the one praying. I had to be the one writing my journal. I had to be the one reading the scriptures. I had to be going to church. I had to be seeking the Lord myself. And so there was no sense for me of – there's never been this sort of shocking moment of, oh, my goodness, what do we really believe? And, oh, what, that happened in our history? Or none of that. Yeah. There's never been any of that because I was reading all about that right from the beginning. And there was no sense of – I never had a sense that the leaders in the church were perfect. We don't believe that. That's not our doctrine. But they do carry keys and they do represent Christ. And so these things have been with me from very young. I know to this moment with clarity beyond words that Joseph Smith saw what he said he saw, that this is the stone cut out of the mountain without hands, that, you know, I know as well as I know anything in my life that it will continue on in its destiny, that it will grow and break forward with or without me. With or without any of us, individually. And so I want to be a part of it. I want to fulfill my own mission within that broader mission.
Yeah, that's fantastic. So that testimony obviously led you to a mission. Where did you serve your mission?
I served in Toronto, Canada, the Canada-Toronto East Mission.
Wow, great. And did you use any French up there, or did you learn French, or was it all English speaking?
There was no missionary spoke French in the mission, but we did have a whole, you have to go further, up into Quebec, for that. But, gotcha. But you, But we did have a whole zone of Chinese speaking missionaries, a whole zone of Spanish speaking missionaries. So, I mean, Toronto is the most multicultural city in the world. And so we taught people from over 100 countries. It was an extraordinary sort of crash course in the world. By the time we were done, we talked, you know, everywhere. People from Ethiopia, of course, all of the countries of Europe, from Iran, from Iraq, from all over Asia. Yeah, an amazing experience. From Somalia.
Awesome.
Yeah, wonderful.
So you came over from your mission and then obviously pursued your studies. And if I remember right from your bio, you got your undergrad in journalism. Is that right?
Yeah, that's right. That's after the law school period. Went to BYU, did my undergraduate in print journalism. And that was because of two reasons, really. One, because I wanted to write. That was what was on the piece of paper, was to teach and to write. And so I wanted to choose a degree that was, and it's either that or English literature. Both of them would have been good options. But the journalism took the edge for me because I loved the idea of asking the right questions. And that being critical factor, you know, we spend a lot of our energy in life being taught how to give the right answers to existing questions, but a deeper spiritual capability and gift, I think, is the ability to ask the right questions that precedes getting the right answers. So journalism was one of the few, very few, undergraduate programs that has an emphasis in questioning and asking questions.
Nice. Well, I definitely have no journalism background, but we'll see how I hack through these questions nonetheless. But I'm definitely learning as I do these interviews. So now, where did you meet? Did you meet your wife at BYU, the typical BYU story, or where did you meet your wife?
The very first part of how we met, so the very beginning, is that having quit law school, coming to BYU now, I'm trying to teach and write. I had been asked to write a column for the Daily Universe, for the newspaper on campus, and I wrote a whole set of those in advance, 200 of them, in fact. They did a cover story in the newspaper and introduced the very first column. So there was a cover story and then the column. And as it turns out, there was never a second column. So it was canceled by somebody further up the chain, not personal to what I'd written, but they just were saying, oh, no, we don't do columnists. We're not doing that for a variety of reasons. And so here, there's all this work suddenly just burned. And I remember sort of complaining about it the day it happened to a friend. And then the spirit just said, just don't you complain. Don't worry about this. It will work for your good. It will work out. And it was just within days of that, I mean, like maybe even the next day, but certainly within a couple of days of that, that Anna, who is the most amazing person in my life and my wife, was reading the article and had more of a connection, more of a sensation of who is this person, and maybe, you know, something of a trigger and a spark of some kind, I suppose. She's not here to defend herself, so I'll just continue down this path. Sure. How I like the narrative.
Absolutely.
And then it turned out that we were both teaching in the MTC, and so we met, moments after this. And so actually, I'd lost my scriptures. She found them. She knew who I was because of the article, and she sent me a note, and that was the beginning.
Awesome.
It was
a love story that continues.
Yes,
I'm sure.
That's right. That's true.
Great. So after, obviously your career progressed, and then you came in contact with Liz Wiseman, and we've had Liz on a number of times. She has been so generous to me and to leading LDS, you know, from, somebody who's a best-selling author to be approached by a cute little podcast like I'm doing, but she's been so wonderful. So how did you first begin working with Liz?
I was at my Stanford doing my graduate work, and so somebody, we were in the same stake, and so somebody made the introduction, And so I became involved in the early research for what grew into Multipliers, and then worked with Liz on every aspect of that book, pre-publication, through publication, and then afterwards. And it was a terrific set of learning, of experiences, and that's that story.
Gotcha. And I've recommended, obviously, that book ad nauseum on the podcast. As such, it's impacted my leadership as I've served as a bishop and in councils, and you know, have helped me come to terms with some of those diminishing characteristics that I hold. But a fantastic book. And so your role there, I mean, you were a co-author of that book. Is that the best way to describe your work there?
Yeah, I think that's right. But there's lots of ways to communicate it. I just was a part of the research, the writing, the selection of language, of stories, of interviewing people. One of the people that I reached out to through that journey and became very good friends with was Larry Gelwicks, who you will know from Forever Strong.
Also had him on the podcast.
He's a good friend of mine, and it has been amazing how he has led, how he's approached things. But it's interesting because he's a leader who has bridged both the Multipliers work. He is a multiplier, but he's also an essentialist, and that's not so normal that somebody can epitomizes both of those principles. And so it's been fun to study his approach from both angles. I've learned a lot through that journey.
Awesome. And we could do hundreds of podcast episodes related around the principles of multipliers. And we've done a few, but I hope to do some in the future. But definitely want to pivot towards your church leadership, and also talking about in the context of essentialism, your other book that you've written. But first, let's talk about your church service. You're currently serving as a bishop. Is that right?
Yes, sir.
And how did that come to be? I mean, obviously nobody expects that. There's no application one fills out, nor would we want to fill out such application. But how long have you been bishop, and how did that happen? What do you remember about being called?
I was called just a bit less than 2.5 years ago. I'd served in a variety of capacities in the ward before that, and I don't know if I say it, one of the things that stood out to me. Well, actually, I'll tell you something, a funny story. So my counselor, it was Rob Maines, my first counselor, and his father is Elder Maines. And I hadn't really expected this, but he flew in for his setting apart. And after the settings apart, he came over to me. He said, well, listen, I only really have one piece of advice for you. He said, just make sure that you don't do anything that requires us to add another paragraph into the handbook.
That's sound advice right there.
and so I've held that up as my great mission statement for the experience. It's been an amazing experience. It's full of learning. It's full of discovery into the human condition. And among them is a sense of the universal struggle of people, that everybody, no matter how successful they are, no matter how they appear, there are real struggles and challenges in their lives. And Anna and I, so we'll summarize this, that nobody gets out without a mortal experience. And so that has been one of many, continual insights into as I've served. You've got home teachers and visiting teachers, and sometimes in that role, people think it just doesn't matter very much whether I go or not. And as bishop, you just know, that it matters. You know why it matters. And so anyway, lots of experiences from it.
Awesome. Well, definitely, and I want to continue that theme of obviously talking from the perspective of your calling, mainly because this is a leadership podcast in the context of LDS leadership. And as I read Essentialism, which those of you that aren't familiar that are listening, Essentialism subtitle is the disciplined pursuit of less. And as I got a hold of this book, I've actually, I have the audio book that I read, I've probably read three or four times, or listened to, obviously. And I recommend it to my business partner, and he read it, and he came to me, and we both had this sort of this aha moment as a business, and we really went back to the drawing board with a lot of things that were the way we're approaching things in our business, and it really impacted us dramatically. And so I thank you for that, the way that it's impacted my life that way, and I continue to revisit it when I just need to reconnect to that disciplined pursuit of less, because there's so much power in that concept. And so maybe tell us, how did you come to decide that this was your next book project, or this is what you wanted to invest your life in, is this concept of Essentialism?
Looking back, it really all started with a moment when my boss at the time emailed me and said, Friday would be a very bad time for your wife to have a baby.
And your wife was pregnant at the time.
Well,
right?
It would be even stranger if she wasn't. But Friday was in fact the day that she went into labor. And so I'm in the hospital and my daughter is born and everybody's healthy, everybody's well. But instead of being focused on this essential moment, I felt pulled. How can I do both? How can I keep both people happy? How can I navigate this? And to my shame, I went to the meeting, and afterwards my boss said to me, the client will respect you for the choice you just made. And I don't know that they did, but even if they did, surely I had made a fool's bargain. And that was when I really learned the simple lesson in hindsight. If you don't prioritize your life, someone else will. And so you've got to make sure that you are really figuring this out, each day. Do what is right, let the consequence follow. Figure out what the priority is, eliminate what's not. And so that was definitely a formative, a defining moment as I look back. I left that experience, left that job ultimately and said, look, why is it that people make the choices they make? Surely I'm not the only person who has been pulled in many different directions, that has felt this tension and of not living in a neutral world where other people have these opinions about how things should be. In fact, I mean, we don't just, one of the things I found is we don't just live in an age of information overload. We live in an age of opinion overload.
That's for sure.
And so in that kind of environment, it's not just as it was in my case, a sort of individualized situation. It's also a societal, cultural situation now for people. People feel pulled, they feel stretched too thin at work and at home most of the time. People feel busy but not productive. People feel this pressure to say yes even when they're overcommitted already. They feel overworked and underutilized. I mean, this is the undisciplined pursuit of more that we're in right now, and the name for it finally was non-essentialism. This is the culture that we're in, and so that was what I found. The question is what you can do about it, and the antidote to the undisciplined pursuit of more is the disciplined pursuit of less but better.
Right, and that's definitely, like you mentioned, that's sort of the default mode that we're in, is the undisciplined pursuit of more, right? Where so many people wake up after years of going to the office or pursuing something that they just sort of get in this going through the motions, and they realize that they're pursuing more, but they don't know why, right? Because there's so much technology, and you talk about this concept of nobody's really, at least in your adult years, nobody's really bored anymore, right? Because we have that smartphone ready to be flicked through Facebook or to check that email. There's always a way to engage your brain in something of that undisciplined pursuit.
Yeah, I have a friend who has studied what it takes to have technology hook people, and he finds that there are some conditions for being hooked for addiction of all kinds. One is that sometimes a certain behavior will produce a real sense of pleasure, of success. And then sometimes the same behavior will produce feelings of real disappointment. And then the third condition is that the first two conditions are randomly assigned. So when you think about somebody who's in, they're in Las Vegas, they're on the slot machines. Those are the conditions. Sometimes something great's going to happen for them. Sometimes something terrible's going to happen, and they don't know when it is. So that's what keeps them in there. That's what keeps you playing. Right. The next one could be bad. The next one could be great. You don't know. Now, that is email. That is having email on our phones, having it with us all the time. It is addiction. That's the environment we're in. I used to think of that as it's a metaphorical addiction, just sort of addicted. No, it's addiction. Well, that's what it is. We 50% of youth believe that they are addicted to their phone. Just barely that research came out about that. I mean, this week. I was reading that. On average, people check their phones 150 times a day. The highest level is 900 times a day.
Wow.
So we're just using this as one example. It's a literal example, but it also serves as a metaphor for just the environment we're in today. I believe that we are today in a busyness bubble. Like other bubbles before it, this bubble, it has an overvalued asset that leads to irrational exuberance in the culture. And so then people behave in ways that in hindsight will look really ridiculous, will look foolish, just like the real estate bubble, right? People were doing things that in hindsight were really foolish. Lots of people, just the bankers. Yes, they did too. They maybe they're primarily responsible, but lots of other people made those kinds of decisions that now we say, oh, of course you shouldn't have done that. Now, the same test exists now. Can we get out of this busyness? Can we act in a way that will look wise in hindsight, even amidst the busyness bubble? That's the challenge. Can we operate in a way that later people will say, well, yeah, you got it right. You were smart. You work through that correctly. And the answer, the only way to do that is, to use the language of essentialism, is to be an essentialist, is to take on a particular approach to your personal leadership and also to your professional leadership. And that's really what the cases I'm making in this book. That's what I think has the power of relevancy now, is to live and to lead as an essentialist.
Right. And I sort of, after reading the book, I get the impression that this is you're addressing, you talk about that relationship with, technology or whatever, but this is really addressing where our culture has taken us, whether on purpose or not, through technology or not, but we are all living, you can ask most people, in our society, how's work going? How's life going? And they generally say busy, right? Tell us about, you use this analogy of the closet. I forget exactly how you term it in the book, but can you tell us about that closet analogy? I think that's important for church leaders to hear and understand.
Well, the challenge is clear. In the closet, we tend to put too much in there. We tend to pursue an undisciplined pursuit of more. That is that we add things from time to time and we rarely go through it all. So in the end, it becomes cluttered. It becomes too full. You can't find anything despite there being lots of things in there. We can't seem to find things that we really love to wear or want to wear. So that's the undisciplined pursuit of more. What's the disciplined pursuit of less look like? It says instead of taking an item off the shelf, looking at it, and then saying, "Well, maybe I'll Maybe it'll come back into fashion again someday. Or maybe, yeah, maybe it will fit me again in the future somehow. Or I could possibly be invited to an event where I need, you know, just that kind of tie. So instead of asking those questions are such broad questions, meaning the answer to those questions is inevitably, yes, of course you might need that again. Of course you might be able to use that sometime in the future, maybe. Now that's so broad. What we would need to do to clear out the closet, the disciplined pursuit of less, would be to continually have a process for carefully selecting just the right few things. So we might ask, do I love it? We might ask, do I wear it often? We might ask, do I look great in this? Or we could use what Marie Kondo says, does it spark joy?
Yeah.
Now, if you ask those questions, what you have left, I know from personal experience, is a lot less. But what you have are just the right things. You have less, but better.
Yeah.
Now, of course, as you already suggested, this is a metaphor for our lives. We're not talking about our closets, although it is literally true. We're talking about the metaphor of our lives in which people are stuffing things into our closets all day long. And so, of course, it's overwhelming. Of course, it's overloaded. Of course, we can hardly get into the closet of our lives. There's just stuff in there all the time. And so this is the environment that any church leader is operating in today. The people they're serving are going to be feeling this in their own lives. Sometimes we ourselves have created this, the traditions of our ward, of the quorum we're in, can suddenly add to this burden unintentionally. And so our job as church leaders is really to strip away all of the non-essentials, to strip away those things that may be good. I mean, this is, you know, Elder Oaks, the whole church knows this phrase now, right? Good, better, best. There's a reason everybody knows that, because it named something that's a real challenge. Now, we have to be careful about this. We have to be thoughtful. Now, I'm not saying that we should – sometimes people could apply essentialism in the wrong way, in a counterfeit way. They might say, well, I'm not going to go to church there because I'm going to spend time with my family,
right?
And that's the right trade-off. But sometimes non-essentialism can be done in a disciplined way. Right. What we need is a disciplined, or, you know, it's the same root word as discipled, a discipled approach, pursuit of what the Lord really wants and when he wants it. That's the obligation. The obligation isn't to our traditions, even good traditions. Our obligation isn't to the past. Our obligation isn't to what everyone else is doing or what every other ward is doing. It's not. Our obligation is much more singular than that. You know, the priority of our life, singular, is the Lord and his agenda. And my job is to figure that out. My job is to figure out if it's popular or not. My job is to figure that out, whether it's what I want or not. And so this is really the celestial version of the idea of essentialism, is can we figure that out? Can we get the discernment clear enough and not just react, not just get pulled into the busyness of whatever calling we have, but to really hear his voice so we're doing his will in his kingdom and not just everything popular now, which is, I think, sort of the default position.
Yeah, and I love that phrase, how you tweak your subtitle there, that the discipled pursuit of less, because that's so powerful to hear. And as I was, you know, reading the book, that's the thought that came to me over and over, because obviously I'm listening to the book, I'm knowing, you know, you're a bishop and you're talking about these concepts, and so I'm sort of thinking about in the context of the church. But and just to use and talk about a concept that you talk about in the book, about the power of saying, you know, no to things. And we've all, in the professional world, I think anybody working there has been in a situation where your supervisor or manager comes to you and says, hey, guess what? Here's a whole big hairy gorilla project that I'm going to now lay on your plate. And you talk about some examples in there of individuals saying, well, if you want me to work on that, which task that you've already given me would you like me to neglect, right? And that's a powerful conversation to have with a manager or a supervisor. But it seems like to me, the thought that came back to me is the culture of the church sort of lays a whole nother layer on the culture of just the culture in general, that this undisciplined pursuit of more is that when we have a, you know, there's so many programs in the church. We have home teaching. We have family history. We have, you know, I just got back visiting a girls' camp last night. So many of these different programs. And then when a priesthood leader or a leader in general comes to you, it's a lot. I guess it's a little more awkward saying no to those things when we feel like that direction is coming through inspired direction. Do you kind of get what I'm getting at, or
I'd be interested in
your thoughts on that?
Oh, absolutely. And you know, we've got to tread wisely through this. We've got to navigate this.
Right.
We've got to navigate this in a sensible way. Let's begin with the idea that I didn't write a book called Noism.
Right.
And the difference really matters. You know, it's about what's essential, and we ought to give thoughtful consideration to all of the requests in our lives, including requests that are made in a church environment. I mean, I remember my mother as a young convert going to church with young children. I don't know if it was five at the time, but certainly little children. And in an effort to be useful, whatever anybody asked her to do, she would simply say yes immediately, no matter what it was, because it's the church and I ought to be doing anything I'm asked to do by anyone, everything and everyone. And she would leave church and she suddenly realized, well, I just got five more things to do. I'm just overwhelmed by this. And so she learned something. Actually, I write it in the book, although I don't give that all that context. She just learned this phrase and she's used it ever since in her life. It is, let me check my calendar and get back to you. So that means she just gets a pause to think, to be sure, not to try to make sure that worldliness wins out over church requirements. That's the wrong trade-off. To make sure that the Lord's voice wins out over any other voice. So that's vitally important. And so that's to have the pause matters. In my own experience, I remember serving in a calling, serving on the High Council, and I'd been asked to work on one, you know, big area, work on missionary work, and then oh, but here's another thing, and here's another thing, and I was now working on three different assignments, and then they came with two more assignments, and that's perfectly reasonable that they should come. They're trying to make certain things happen. It's perfectly reasonable for me to ask, as I did ask, look, I am very happy to do all of these five projects. I'm happy to do those, but I think I'll just do them sort of averagely well, or maybe I can do them. I can be good at them all, but I can't go big in them all. I just can't. So would you prefer I sort of did good at five different things, or would you prefer I went really big on one of them? I think that's a very respectful thing to ask. I think that's not, there's nothing inappropriate about that. That is part of counseling together wisely. And the response was almost immediate. Oh, we definitely want you to work on this one big area. We want you on mission work. That's what we want you on. And so for the next year, I was able to completely focus my energies on that. And it made a big difference. It was the difference between sort of a bit of everything versus something, one main thing. And everything, I mean, we had 400 families in the state create family mission plans. We had baptisms went up higher than they'd been in several years previously. That's because we were able to focus on fewer things. And that was inspired. And that's part of that's what I think essentialism looks like. It doesn't look like somebody saying, oh, I just don't do callings. It doesn't look like somebody saying, you know, I just opt out of everything to do with the church because I think other things, a community is more important. No, it's not that. But it is a perpetual approach to what the Lord wants us to do. And I'll tell you that even though this is a doctrinal path less traveled by, it doesn't make it less doctrinal. If you read the scriptures end to end with an essentialist lens, you just will be amazed at how continual this theme runs like a golden thread through almost the entire standard works. The divine trade-offs are a requirement of our lives. there's no point in talking about agency unless there are trade-offs we're going to have to make, unless we're going to have hard trade-offs to make. This is key to coming here, is that we can't do it all. We can't do all of the good things. We can't even do all of the great things. Yeah. So what are we to do? Well, we can either really not use our agency and just react to it all, let these things act upon us. We can be acted upon even by good things. Or we have to go to the Lord, work things out in our own mind, try to figure out what the essential things are, go to the Lord for confirmation, seek his revelation, seek his will, and ultimately arrive at what is essential. Not what's good, not what's great, what's essential. And that to me is far from being an unsustaining position or an unhelpful position. That is the exact position we're supposed to be in. That's the position the Lord was in. He didn't feel the obligation, or didn't allow it to make him do it. When he's on the earth, he didn't feel this obligation to do everything that the law of Moses was teaching him to do. He didn't feel the obligation to fulfill all of the expectations of society or all of the expectations of the aristocracy of his time, the religious leadership. He, even when that made him unpopular, he didn't feel that obligation. He felt the obligation to keep coming back to what really was essential, his father's will for him. I mean, think about it. All the things Jesus didn't do, and it's a breathtaking thing to consider.
Yeah, that's powerful. I mean, we focus so much, even that the old time phrase, what would Jesus do? But to really step back and read the scriptures from a point of view of what did Jesus not do?
What did he not do? And not just the sin, which of course is a big, big deal, the big sins. Yes, we know he didn't do that, but neither did, sin has one of the root definitions of sin is of its original meaning is to miss the mark. And there are all sorts of ways we can miss the mark by pursuing good things. There were all sorts of good missions he did not pursue. There are all sorts of problems going on in Jerusalem, in Israel, that he didn't touch. There were all sorts of people that needed to hear the gospel outside of Israel that he didn't go to. So I think it's striking. I said it already, breathtaking to think about it from this lens. And to realize we do not have the obligation to do everything perfect now. We do not have that obligation. That is an undoctrinal position. And yet somehow, because of the culture out of the church, and because of how culture affects all organizations, so it's even true within the church, I'm not suggesting we take worldly ideas and bring them into the church. I'm suggesting we need to take worldly ideas out of the church. In our experience there, that we have to make sure that we don't create this sense of you've got to do it all and you've got to do it all now. That's something we can, that essentialism maybe can give people permission not to do, give people permission to go a different way.
So from your perspective as bishop, with so many callings, so many programs, so many lines in the handbooks, how do you create that culture of essentialism within your ward?
I don't feel like I have all the answers for this. It is a challenge because for a lot of reasons, because we have done things a certain way in the past because working out what's essential is itself hard and continual work. But I will say this, that one of the things is to, I can give you an example of something I think that we've done that works. Every week in ward council, instead of spending, we don't have an hour. We do it tighter than that. It helps keep us essentialist. But out of the normal meeting that we do that people do in ward council, it would be very easy to imagine using up a lot of time on a policy matter or on activities that need to be planned or on a whole variety of things that are secondary. And so one of the things we've done to address this is we go through priority names. So each auxiliary each week reports on their priority name from last week and what their action was. And then we talk about what the priority name is for within each auxiliary for this coming week. And that means that what it helps us to do is it helps us focus on, on individuals, as Elubenna talks about it, about the one. It helps us make sure that we're dealing with people and serving individuals instead of programs. And I have found that it took me a while to come to that, to understand that. But that has proven to be a way that you can't walk out of that meeting. I mean, I don't know, of course people could, but I don't walk out of that meeting. And I don't think other people do, feeling like, oh, well, we just had another meeting. Yeah, you walk out going, we have spent time talking about individuals who we can do something about together as a council or individually, and we have this week to go and do those things. And so that has been one concrete thing that we've done to apply essentialism inside the ward.
So when you say priority name, that's a name of an actual individual in your ward that auxiliary is going to focus on.
That's correct. It's a name of an individual that an auxiliary is raising that we may all be able to support in some way, but it's certainly, but yes, that's what it is.
Gotcha. Now I'm intrigued by, you say you generally don't have an hour for ward council. Is that right?
That's right. Yes.
And how do you stay disciplined and discipline everybody in the ward council to stay on that time frame? Or do you set a time frame to say we're only going to be here for a half hour? How does that happen?
Well, I mean, we meet before church, so that's a forcing function.
Oh, sure.
So we meet at 8 and we go through till 8:45. For a long time, it was just half an hour, and I just felt we just need a little more buffer to be able to get through that exercise of priority name for the week, what we've done from the week before, and then what the priority name is and what we're going to do going forward for the next week. And so that's it. That's how that forcing function works.
Gotcha. Any other thoughts in relation to essentialism related to meetings? Because we've discussed this on Leading LDS quite a bit. And I put out an article about a year ago that said that the 7 unbreakable rules of a meeting, and it was maybe more strongly titled than I meant it to be. But one of those rules is that no meeting is worth going over an hour, and in especially these administrative meetings. So and I want to mention there is that individuals came back and said, well, by doing that, by setting yourself by compressing the meeting into a certain time frame, you are limiting the spirit of revelation that can happen there. And I don't agree with that, but what would your thoughts be in regards? I mean, do you feel like those meetings are still full of the spirit, still full of inspiration and progress?
Well, I think that I don't prefer the idea of having ward council have a broader, okay, so we're going to, sometimes it could be 2 hours, sometimes it could be 3 hours, sometimes it's an hour and a half. I like that it's tight. I like that it just challenges us to be disciplined, that it challenges us to stay focused, to do it. That's why we do it every week, so that you're having a small connection, smaller footprint more often. I think there's cumulative advantage to that approach, even to the revelation. But it's impactful to me that the Council of 12 meet every Thursday together to talk. Mm-hmm. So I do think there's value to be said to have a disciplined time, to have a disciplined schedule. I mean, as to whether I think that it has to be a rule 1 hour? No, I don't think I would necessarily buy that. But I do think that having singular purpose, as I read somewhere once, to have a tight purpose and a loose agenda, rather than a tight agenda and a loose purpose, seems to be the essentialist approach that certainly I have a preference for. So to say, okay, so sometimes as a bishopric we meet, and instead of saying, okay, well, we're going to just talk about everything we could talk about in the ward, which is really an endless set of potential issues, we'll say, okay, we're going to meet, and it's a callings meeting. The whole time we're going to work is just going to be figuring out the callings that need to be assigned, and that is the whole purpose of the meeting. So that again is one way to apply essentialism in a way that it creates a forcing function, helps you not to be just going all over the place and just talking. I mean, that's the problem. I think this is what makes meetings exhausting for people in the church or elsewhere, is where you just, you know, if you take on too many different subjects, if you just bounce around on all different subjects, then you know you've not done anything. You know you're just sort of, you're just trying to drink in the ocean, and it can't be done.
I'm curious, as you, obviously, when you wrote this book, I would imagine you were called to bishop after sort of the main book was written. Is that accurate?
I was called a month or 2 months before the book came out, in an act of cosmic significance, and nice. Maybe a cosmic joke.
Nice. Is there anything, as you've been serving as bishop, any unique characteristics of this calling that has caused you to struggle with certain essentialism principles that you may not have struggled with in your professional life?
Everything about the calling is a tension with essentialism. Literally everything. Because at the heart of essentialism is an idea that you know, one can disagree with, but this is the challenge, right? Is it true that everything is essential, or is it true that almost everything is non-essential and only a few things are essential? A non-essentialist believes everything's important. It all has to be done. An essentialist believes that almost everything is non-essential and a few things are incredibly valuable. Now, I maintain the second category. I believe that. I believe that's what the doctrine teaches. I believe that that's what we can be demonstrated in almost every field of human endeavor. So then you say, okay, now you're called as a bishop. What are the essential things? The whole game is taken to the next level. Game is the wrong word, but the whole challenge is taken to the next level, because there's so many good things you could do. You know, it's like somebody playing in soccer in high school, and then suddenly going to play in the World Cup, and you're playing at such a higher challenge level. That's the challenge. Now, I give considerable energy, time, resources to my calling, and I believe that's appropriate. I believe that's right. I believe that's essential. But within that, there's still far, far more need and challenge and opportunity, far more than I could possibly do. You know, I don't mean like a factor of, it's not twice as much. It's not like if I added 10 more hours to the calling each week, or 20 more hours, I could suddenly just do it all. It's nowhere close, right? It's like if I had 300 hours more, I still maybe wouldn't be close. So what that means is that one's discernment must increase. One must go to the Lord more continually, more purposefully than ever before. Who is the person I can serve today? Who is the one? Out of all of these different people with all of their different needs, all their different challenges, who is the one I can serve the best? And start there. And so that is the continual challenge. And I don't mean that I resent the challenge. It's just inherently part of being called as a bishop. I don't believe it would be a counterfeit of essentialism to say that I should simply just do less. That's not what the book's about. That's not what I believe at all. But I do think the obligation is for me to gain greater discernment than I've ever had before, to use that mantle and to seek for more of it, to seek for the charity necessary to discern the very best thing to do and the best way to serve and who I can respond to now. I mean, President Monson, when he was a bishop, struggled with exactly the same thing. And the struggle is important. We're supposed to be in the struggle. The scriptural term is the wrestle. We're supposed to engage in the wrestle. And he, you remember this story, he's in a stake meeting. He's on the stand. The stake president is speaking. He's a bishop at the time. He doesn't want to seem disrespectful. He's struggling with the social obligation in that moment, feeling like he should go to the hospital to the person he knows is sick there. And he leaves. Finally, he just falls. He cannot wait any longer. It's in the closing hymn, he just runs off the stand. He runs to the hospital. He gets there, and the person has already died. And The nurse says, "Are you Bishop Monson?" "Yes." "He was calling to you before he passed." He wept from that experience. I mean, he learned. I mean, that is a quintessentially essentialist moment where he said, you know, I'm not going to just do the social obligations of my calling ever again. That's not what the focus will be. I am going to seek the voice of the Lord and let that essential, be attuned to that essential voice and obey it. Now, the way of the essentialist that he's describing isn't an easier way, but it's a more meaningful way. It's his highest point of contribution. And he's pursued that for the rest of his life. And so it's, you know, it has been typical, even as being president of the church, that as he's going to some conference where 10,000 people are waiting for him to speak, that he'll still be waiting at the back and they will wait to start that meeting. It will be late because on the way, as he's walking into the room, he sees somebody who he feels prompted to talk to. And the repetition of that experience, that is the story of his life. That's why he has all these stories. It's not because he's done everything. It's not because he's just been undisciplined into whatever anything happened around him, any need from anyone. It's because he's been constantly on the Lord's errand. That's the title of his biography, on the, isn't it? Yeah, on the Lord's errand. Right. And that's the difference. Essentialism is about finding the errand from the Lord, not just doing what the social environment is requiring, even the social environment within our ward, within our calling, within our quorum. And it's totally necessary, isn't it? Because if we want to break through to the next level in any endeavor, including in our callings, we simply will have to make different trade-offs than people have made previously. And that takes courage. It takes leadership. I don't think that's easy. I don't think that's easier, not in the short term. But in the long run, there's no breakthrough story of any kind that didn't require that kind of sacrifice. Think of how easily we use the word sacrifice in an unthinking way. I mean, sacrifice, the literal sacrifice. If I sacrificed a lamb, right? If you and I were together and I sacrificed a lamb, you'd remember that for the rest of your life. You'd think this was the strangest thing you've ever had happen. You'd be like, Greg McKeown is a crazy man. You would. I'm not exaggerating.
Sure.
Kill this animal right here. The blood, the everything. And yet that is what sacrifice was, right? For thousands of years, there was a very, very distinct reminder of what sacrifice is and what it means. Sacrifice is the same idea as to decide. It's to cut or to kill. It means to eliminate. It means to make a trade-off. President Monson in that moment, in the hospital story, wasn't making a trade-off. He was trying to do both. It comes full circle to the story I talked about earlier. In that moment, when I was in the hospital and I went to that meeting, I wasn't making a trade-off. I was trying to do both. And that is that's like counter to the whole plan of salvation. The whole plan of salvation is that we must make trade-offs. We are not permitted not to, right? We can't escape them. And so the position that I have is that we can either pursue a sort of, respond to that challenge in a reactive, undisciplined, undiscipled way, well-intentioned but undiscipled, or we can pursue it with a discipled intention, and it's the Lord's will or bust. And that's what I think it means to be an essentialist and to lead as an essentialist.
That concludes my interview with Greg McKeown. I don't have words to adequately explain how much I enjoyed that interview. To hear that, and it just speaks to my soul, this idea of the discipled pursuit of less. The discipled pursuit of less. That's such a powerful phrase, because it isn't that we're just too busy. We're overwhelmed. We got so much to do. We're trying to get through it. And maybe I just need to say no to things to just make life easier. It's not about making life easier. Like Greg said, it's not about doing less, but it's about being more discipled, more disciplined. That's such a powerful, powerful point of view. And as leaders out there, as we consider that, those teachings and those writings, as we consider that idea, As we approach our callings on Sunday, or if we have a busy schedule, we have got to step away from the busyness and think of, what is the one thing? What is the one person I could touch today, right? That's an overwhelming example of from President Monson was mentioned here. What is the one person I can touch today? Who's the one person I can call, I can reach out to, and I can learn their name, whatever it is, right? Or what's the one meeting? If we could only have one meeting today, what would it be? And what would we talk about? What would the focus be? What would the focus of my leadership be today? I encourage you to seek after a copy of Greg McKeown's book. If you go to leadinglds.com and on the show notes of this episode, you will find a link that'll take you to Amazon to purchase that, to purchase his book if you're so intrigued. And I encourage you to do so through that link, and it will also send some support to Leading LDS as an affiliate to sending you to Amazon. So that's a great way to do that. But definitely, however you do it, through the library, through a borrowed copy, whatever it is, I encourage you to read this book and ponder over the concepts taught within it. And we didn't even scrape the surface of the contents of this book, and I think you'll find more inspiration and guidance there. As always, we encourage you to contribute $1 a month to Leading LDS and what we're trying to do here. I'm working on getting a donate button on leadinglds.org, and so you can go there, and so if it's not there, you can go to leadinglds.org/help, H-E-L-P, and there at the top of the page, there'll be a link to our Patreon page where you can submit $1 a month, and that dollar a month will take us a long way, and hopefully we can continue to create quality content much like this interview and reach out to more influencers and thinkers within the context of the church and arrive to a greater level of leadership, a discipled level of leadership, a discipled pursuit of less. Until next time, be a leader and not a calling.